Accession number 18463, reel 13.
Reel 13.
Well, we're standing in the ditch there with about a foot of water and all mud spattered as the brigadier has driven past us and not stopped. And I must say I was open mouthed because I'm sure it would have been a sight to see, because I expected any moment the brigadier's jeep to be shot up by the tank. But he went blithered off past the tank, turned left, off up to the Argyles. And I looked back round then, and then I'm absolutely ashamed of the section. I had a camouflage, silk camouflage scarf on, but they had pink floral curtains, I should think it must have been, great big lumps of that wrapped round their neck, and I thought, well, I'm definitely in trouble now. I haven't got him killed, but he isn't going to be too pleased about that. And we went on a bit, about another 200 yards, and the lads are moaning and groaning, and I had a bit of sympathy for them, to be quite honest. But it did seem a bit pointless going the last 200 or 300 yards. So we got out on the road and went back to the company and reported to Albert that we just seen the brigadier. We didn't mention that we'd let him through and the concerns over it. Now, they hadn't known that the brigadier had gone through, so they tell the company commander, who alerts everybody up. And I don't know if he did. He probably visited us on the way back. He might not even know we were there. But anyway, the result of this was that either during the course of that day, or maybe the next day, a message came through that nobody was to wear, they could all wear scarves as long as they were khaki or camouflage, and there was to be no more pink scarves. So I guess that we were responsible for that order. About 1100, the Albert came over again and said, I want you to take a patrol down to contact the Argyles. And I must admit, at the time I thought, he's not too pleased that I've let the brigadier go through and cleared it all up. Anyway, we cleared off. It stopped raining by this time. It was quite reasonably dry, and the ditches were still full, but the rain had stopped pouring across the road. And we started off just the rifle section. The LMG section stayed behind, guarding our section perimeter. Went off down, got to the tank, and clambered all over it, and nobody had been there. It was actually knocked out, completely knocked out. Although it would have been an armoured pillbox, I suppose, if you wanted to. And we had to turn left and go down, I guess, a mile, maybe a mile and a half, toward the Argyles. Got down to the Argyles, and there was, I had to report to the adjutant, Captain Slim. That's Bill Slim's son. And he was chatting to their padre and a chap who I didn't recognise at the time, was in fact Reginald Thompson, the author who wrote, I think it was Cry of Korea, or some, wrote a book about the Korean War. And he was there in a blueberry, and there was a couple of American reporters there. So I waited until they'd finished, and they were chatting away there and taking photographs of each other and what have you. Reported to Captain Slim, who just pointed out the various company positions to me so I could go back and tell the company commander. And we set off back in. It was quite good, this quite a long patrol, this. And of course, we dried out in the meantime, which was rather good. You know, they were a bit damp and soggy, but they were drier than we've been for a long time. And, of course, it took longer to dry out now because we got the long johns and what have you on underneath. Got back to the company, reported in, told, you know, to the company commander, and we stood down then for the rest of the day. Well, there wasn't much of the day left, in actual fact, but what there was of it, we stood down. And now things began to calm down a little bit now. The patrols were going out, coming back. I think there was a petrol shortage at this time, apparently, and we couldn't go out on vehicles. They were coming back and saying that they were finding bodies in the ditches. Somebody said they went on the Taishan Road and found all the head people, headmen, what have you, of Taishan, their hands bound and shot in the ditches, but I don't know how they could have known they came from Taishan. It might be just a story. And then there were clashes between the Australians and ROC patrols who were wandering about our area where they shouldn't have been, and we were stopped patrolling, we were drawn in. In fact, we came down off the hills, and all we had was LMG posts up on the hills at night. We began to sleep into a couple of little houses down there. Quite a good little thing going there. But what we're building up to now, of course, is the new offensive. I can't remember the date. It might have been the 24th of November. I know that Thanksgiving Day was the big thing in the American Army, and they were all interested in that, and they build up of supplies and what have you. And that's the last Thursday in November, and I believe it was the 23rd, I can't be sure. And the offensive was probably the 24th the next day. But Thanksgiving was a marvellous thing. I mean, we had a wonderful time. Like a Christmas dinner, turkey, roast turkey, cranberry sauce, and everything you could conceivably think of. And what air cooks had done, they somehow or other, they laid on some trestles. We had some American gunners with us. And the Americans, they did the old, they sat at the table. Well, we all sat at the table, as many as could get around this table, which was laid with blankets on the top of it. And the officers and warrant officers and sergeants, as is tradition at Christmas in the British Army, served the Americans. They didn't serve us, they served the Americans. And we had a wonderful time. Really, Thanksgiving Day was a real beam feast. I can't remember if we had beer, maybe we did, I can't remember. Probably had a can or something other, but I can't really remember. There wasn't much beer in those days. And the next day, the offensive started. And as far as we knew, it was all going well, all seemed to be going well. In fact, whilst I was up on the LMG post on our position there, an American artillery unit went past, and I called out to one of them, "Where are you going?" Because they were going back towards Pachon, and he said, "Home, we're going home." And of course, that had been a thing that we were all hoping to go home. And going back just a little bit, of course, on the 7th of November, which is when we moved over to take up to the Australians, we'd been expecting to be withdrawn. That was the time. In fact, the colour sergeants had come round, asked how many dollars we wanted on the boat going back to Hong Kong, and we should have gone then. And then, of course, the following day it was all cancelled, and we were back in it again, because we were only there as a temporary arrangement until 29 Brigade arrived. We should have gone home. That's why we hadn't got any winter kit, because we weren't going to need it. We wouldn't need winter kit. We'd be back in Hong Kong for the winter. Anyway, getting back to the offensive, the morning of the, I think it's the 27th, yes, the 27th of November, it was a really low cloud day, you know, black and horrid looking, and clouds very, very low over the hills there. And we got the word that we were moving, things weren't going too well. And we were going over to another division, a division we'd never operated with before, to the 2nd Division, who were over at Cunery. We'd never been that way before. We'd always been with Milburn's Corps, and with 1st Cav or 24th Div. Anyway, we packed up everything. It wasn't much, as far as we were concerned, wasn't much packing to do, and just your bedroll and stuff like that. We stood out in the paddy field there, and here was a rather strange thing. A day before, the CO had a fantastic idea that every platoon would have it was like an oil drum stood up on end, the top cut off and a lid put in it, and a trap door down the bottom and a chimney put on it, and every platoon would have one of these, and we'd all be fantastically warm. It would be lovely. The trouble was, of course, they were so bulky you couldn't move them. And we hadn't got the fuel. There wasn't the fuel around to pack these up and burn them. And he'd come up on the, I think it was probably on the Thanksgiving Day, maybe the day before. And he'd been a bit miffed because his wonderful boilers were out in the paddy there, rusting away there. And we'd all gone down, and they got our precious fuel and set one going. And we all said, "Oh, aren't they fantastic?" So, yeah, it's fantastic. And he went off pleased, and we left them out in the paddy. And now we're off, and there they are. They're going to be left for the Chinese. So transport came, and we loaded up. American transport always arrived when you were going anywhere important, but if you're withdrawing, it never arrived. And understandably so, because they had to look after their own units, and we were just a sort of an odd job outfit as far as they were concerned. And we went out, and it's rather funny, but there were two trailers there, American trailers, loaded down, there were the tarpaulins across the top, abandoned, God knows what was inside there. Went off through, down through Pak Chong, which was pretty dead by this time, and turned left and went off down. Now we're going down to back down to the bridges, which the blown bridges, and along the route, which we'd gone on the 5th, and poor old dead Chinese is still laid out in the paddy there, and all the other dead that we'd seen, and the trenches, the Australian trenches. Went off down now to the river, turned left, went along on the northern side of the river to Anju, and across the river there on a sandbag bridge. I think there was a pontoon bridge, but we went across the sandbag bridge, and it was the ice flows and frozen, what have you. Then over the river, we turned left, and we're heading off now for Coonaree, and it was obvious things were not going too well, because there were loads and loads of poor civilians walking along there with their things on their head, their, you know, little packs, and the children being carried, and children themselves carrying children. Very tragic sight, civilians. And one could only think that they were not so much, I don't think they were trying to, as the media of the time said, I don't think they were trying to escape from the Chinese or the North Koreans. Or I think they were just trying to escape from everybody, and probably the bombing, you know, more perhaps than anything else. They just wanted to escape the war and maybe live another week longer. Anyway, we eventually, I think we crossed over a railway line or something, right? And we came up to where Coonaree was. Now, Coonaree is a funny old place, because it's only the very older maps that call it Coonaree. It's called Cunmuree or something like that, or Kayshon in actual fact, all the later maps. And the maps, funny enough, at that time, but we all call it Coonaree, as most people of that era did. We were dumped along the side of the road, the railway track on one side of us, and a little bit of paddy along the side of the road there. Frozen solid, really frozen. Very, very cold it was now. Although we've got our winter kit on. We'd had the pile hats issued by this time, and I think we'd had gloves and scarves and all sorts of things. If incidentally, one rather interesting thing that we had issued was a dishcloth. It was about, I think, 12 inches long, 9 inches wide. And we said to the customer, what's this? He said, it's a scarf. He said, well, it can't be a scarf. You can't get it around your neck. And you could just about get it around your neck and tie it if you really... It was a dishcloth, but it was issued as a scarf. And, well, naturally, we used it as a dishcloth, and they'd all gone by this time. Anyway, we parked on the side of the road. We were told not to dig in because we were going to move at any moment. And it was all fairly bustly. There were guns, artillery just down the road firing most of the time. But for some reason or other, we thought they were Turks. They may or may not have been Turks. And they said Corps HQ was just down the road. And then we saw for the first time Turks marching along. Turkish soldiers. I suppose about a good platoon of them came by. But there was none of the repartee that there usually is between units. They had heads down, just plodding along there, dressed in American helmets, long overcoats, and baggy sort of woolly trousers that sort of hung over their American boots. There was no repartee at all between them, and we you know, a bit surprised at that. They went off down the road, another lot came along later, and when evening came, the word came that the bedding rolls were all going to be issued. Because the main bedding rolls were always carried on the company three-ton truck, but by this time they'd got enormous. People had loads of stuff in them they shouldn't have had, and they'd got to be stripped down. And the following morning, when they went back, if they were not stripped down, and they could see that straight away, they'd just throw them aside, and you'd lose your bedding. So we got into these, and I didn't have much. Funny enough, I had a lot of North Korean epaulets and bits of paper and stuff like that, North Korean stuff. and I had my Aussie hat, so I shoved that on the fire. I was sorry to see that go. Oh, and I also had a North Korean grey overcoat, which I picked up somewhere, a very, very thin thing. I mean, it wasn't worth a wind. I was using it for a blanket. And put it all on the fire, and people had burp guns and all sorts of things, pipes from the Nakdong, all went on the fire. I thought the burp went on the fire, but I later found out that it didn't, and the guy threw the magazine away and kept the burp in his bedroll. The following morning, everybody's beginning to say now, we're in retreat. And I'm always an optimist. I can't believe, you know, I couldn't possibly believe that we could be in retreat. But up at the crossroads, there were big 8-inch guns coming back. And I remember saying to a chap, well, they just repositioned them. They're not in retreat. We couldn't possibly be in retreat. Not a massive army like this with all its air support and guns and tanks and what have you. Anyway, we took the bedding rolls back. And at the same time as we took the bedding rolls back, which are slimmed down, I might add by now, because no one wants to lose their bedding, blankets and all have been chucked away, extra blankets put on the fire. And when we went back, we were given two Christmas cards. One was a Middlesex one, which presumably had been intended for us when we were in Hong Kong, because it had got the old B stables inside, Middlesex badge on the front. And the other one was a 27 Brigade one, a smaller one, white with 27 Commonwealth Brigaders we were then on the front, and we just filled them in with a bit of pencil. I suppose they must have had envelopes. I guess they did have envelopes. And took them back to the colour sergeant, and they were going off for Christmas. Well, mine got home, though apparently the truck was eventually shot up and the lot got lost. But mine did eventually get home, and I still got them now. But that was a Christmas card effort. It was scrawled out in pencil. And shortly after that, we were issued... Oh, I think at the same time as we issued the card, we were given a pair of socks. White woolen socks. Fantastic. They're really good socks, they were. All impregnated with oil. You could rub it. It was loose in them, as if they'd been dipped in oil. And we slipped these on over the top of our grey socks. And they were fantastic. They were really, you know, as long as your boots had enough space in them, which they were a bit soggy, the boots in those days. And they were very, very good. And the oil apparently helped your feet. And we were also issued with a pair of, I don't know, chamois leather, I suppose you'd call it, gloves, English gloves, with a long tape, which went round your neck. But they were white, and they weren't too popular in actual fact. But more important, they didn't have a trigger finger, so they weren't a great deal of good at all. You'll see photographs of the Argyles wearing them, but I don't remember any of our chaps wearing them at all. Shortly after that, we got the word that we were going to move, and that if the transport didn't arrive, we would be marching, and we could expect to have to fight our way through, because somebody had the Chinese had slung a roadblock across behind us. And we, about 1 o'clock, I guess, we started to pack up. We started to move out onto the road, march down to the road junction, turn left, and lined up there with all our kit and bedding rolls and what have you. The transport was going to follow on behind, and the Argyles went through us first. They passed. They were leading, obviously. Some people say two Australian companies went through, and I'd be honest, I didn't see them. They may well have done. I just didn't see them. But the Australians had a lot more transport than us, so they could move two of their companies on transport. And I know they were bringing up the rear. I did see them. But I didn't see the two marching companies. And it's rather one of the Argyles, he'd got his hood back, laid across the back of his pack, and inside it was a little puppy's head poking out, so he got a little friend with him he was taking with him. And we stood there on the side of the road, sections out, you know, a section on each side of the road, as you always do, and platoon headquarters in the middle, and we were going to move off. Where we've been like 2 or 3 yards between intervals between, in you know, the normal attack order. And the adjutant was there. And one of the funny things, I can never make this out why this was, we had these parlour hats with a peak, and everybody liked the parlour hat with a peak up, and, you know, the flaps tied up on top. But the ruling in the battalion was that the peak would be down. All the officers wore them down. we all wore them up. Adjutant's there, and of course I got a telling off for having me peak up. I had to put it down. But I'm sure the adjutant probably thought I was just bloody mindedness on my part, but it wasn't. Once the peak was down, I couldn't see. I didn't think I could see enough, and I wanted to peek up to see everything that was going on all around me. And we moved off. We were leading, actually. And we were leading section, in actual fact, as well. And naturally, as soon as I got away from the adjutant, went the old peak again. Marching along, we were on the right-hand side of the road, marching along. And another strange thing happened. A lorry went by, and American lorry, and perched on the top were a couple of young Korean children. And it looked like it was rolls of blankets or carpets or something like that. They were laid right up to the top of the tailboard and whistled by. Then another one came along, and I looked, oh God, it's bodies. God knows how many there were in these. I mean, we used to get 30 or 40 live ones in with all their equipment, but these were laid like sardines. They just laid them in there right across the floor of the truck and then built them up until they were right up to the top of the tailboard. But this lot, the first lot had been wrapped in blankets. This lot weren't, and they were just, you know, no hats, just you could just see the heads and bloody uniforms. And these three little Korean boys on this one, there were two on the previous one, three on this one, were just standing on the top of the bodies, holding on to they hadn't got a tarpaulin over them. This one hadn't, the first one had, this one hadn't, and they were just sort of dancing about on the bodies. I imagine that they were being taken back to the divisional area where they were going to be buried, I presume. I don't know. The Americans have strange habits with bodies. They are a little bit inclined not to cover them up too much as we normally do. Anyway, they whistled by. And in fact, I've never met anybody yet that actually saw them and could remember them. And I'm glad they didn't, because I just said to someone, did you see that? That was full of bodies. He said, nah. But it was absolutely two lorry loads of bodies. A little bit farther on, we stopped, and on the side of the road, that would be about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I guess. And once you stop, you brew up if you can. And Nikki went racing over into one of the houses there, came back with the door, and her doors are sort of a trellis work with paper over them. They're fantastic for fires, but they're not, no, the people don't get too pleased. And suddenly behind him came a little North Korean chap, elderly chap, with a little pile of logs. And he's trying to persuade us, and Nick doesn't want to, because he's already saying, look, this is lovely firewood. And we're saying, well, no, give him back his door. So he took his door, and he went off with it, but the wood he gave us was no good at all, so we never did get a fire going. And Nick, I said to Nick, well, what happened? He said, well, I went up to the nearest house, saw this door, ripped it off. I never knew there was anybody in there. He said, there were all these startled faces looking out. And he said, I'm running off with the door, and this old chap's running after me, just taking time to pick up a few logs. And we gave him back his door. I mean, to be honest, I had a nasty feeling that the next day, unless they moved out, they would have gone the way of a lot of other people. Anyway, we didn't get air brew at all, so we just had a swig of frozen water and probably had some biscuits or something, I can't really remember, and we set up again, we formed up again, and we just moved off, no more than two or three paces, and the company commander's in his jeep with his signallers, sitting just right by my section, and there was heavy machine gun fire from our left flank, that would be to the east, and we all stopped and faced that way, and it went on a little bit. Sounded like 50 caliber, I just said. Probably, maybe tank, could have been Russ, could have been anybody. We thought at the time it was Turks. I don't know why we thought that. Probably because we'd seen them march off in that direction and we thought their guns were in that direction. But it was rather strange then. The company commander got out of his jeep and put his pack on. I'd never seen him with his pack on before. And I thought, my golly, we're in trouble here. And we expected now that the roadblock was just a little bit farther on down the road, although why the Argyles hadn't hit it, I couldn't begin to imagine. Anyway, we marched on, and the machine gun fire got faded away then on our left, because the roads were bending and winding, you know, all over the place. And we passed an American field hospital. I couldn't believe it. There's this field hospital. People came out and watched us, and I had an urge to say, pack up, get out. You know, you're going to be overrun if you don't. And over there on the other side of the road from the field hospital was a bulldozer carefully levelling out a patch, presumably for more tents and what have you. I had no idea why. And we just marched on. You had this sort of guilty feeling. Here we are leaving these rear echelon people to fend for themselves. Anyway, we came along. We're along the road, which is virtually level with the Chong Chong River. We came to a junction, turned left, crossed over a little bit of railway line. There was a couple of houses there. And we turned left now. And now, from now on, it got dark. It was very dark. In fact, it was black. And there was a moon, and it was frost. And this march down through what we call Coonery Pass, it was pretty terrible. I can't really remember much of it, and I'm sure nobody can. People think they can. You remember little bits of it. I can remember a chap ahead of me, a grenade on the floor, and I thought, oh by golly, they're throwing their grenades away, but he just dropped off his belt, and I picked it up and put it in my pocket. And then a little bit farther, we stopped by an opening, and looking out over this opening, it must have been an American stores or something that had been looted. There was, I don't know what they were, but there was white lumps all over the ground there where people had looted the stuff and gone through it. It's just started to move off again, and one of the chaps, I remember him, I know his name even now, and he suddenly said, I've had enough, and ran off into the house, one of the houses, and sat down. And I must admit, we were all pretty tired by this time, and the general consensus was, well, if he wants to stop, let him stop. You know, we didn't have too much pity. We were all in the same state. I should have gone and got him, but I didn't. He wasn't in my section, as it happened. And we marched on, but fortunately, Jimmy Wilde, who was literally running up and down the column, keeping everybody going, snapping at our heels and keeping us, sort of pressing us on all the time, saw him and raced over and said, come on, you must keep on, you know, they're not far behind us, and it could be anywhere along the road here. And the chap wouldn't, but anyway, he took pity on him and he put him on a vehicle. The vehicles were slowly going through us, incidentally, by this time. And about this time, the Aussie companies that were going on their transport began to slowly pass us. We were over on the left on the road by this time. We're in a bit of a jumble by this time. Because every time the column stopped, which it was doing regularly, you literally bumped into the chap in front of you and hung onto his pack, and he hung onto the person in front. We were, I guess, the only expression I could use is we were pretty knackered by this time. As the Aussies went by, they were calling out, up the mids, and singing the old Barrow Boy song and things like that, because a lot of them were English. They'd gone out there and joined the American Army. Loads of them were English. And I don't know if we answered, perhaps we did, I can't remember. We were pretty shattered by this time. And we went on, and I guess it must have been about midnight, I would guess. We started, incidentally, we'd been marching continuously, except for very short breaks, since about 1 o'clock. I think the border I says 1:15, that's probably about right. And about midnight, we stopped on a slope, where it sloped down into a valley, and the road dropped off to the right-hand side, hills on the farther side of that. And most of the people just laid against the side, because they thought if they sat down, they wouldn't get up again, leant on their rifles and things. And I did a stupid thing. I sat on the road. And it was a stupid thing to do, because we were soaked in perspiration, which instantly...